From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour was made at Indian Ladder Farms at the foot of the Adirondacks and the Catskills. You might have seen the Indian Ladder Farms profiled in a recent story in the New York Times. Here was their headline. When picking apples on a farm with 5,000 rules, watch out for the ladders. The story focused on what is often referred to as regulatory fatigue. The Times reported on rules related to, yes, ladders and food handling and a lot more. Ultimately, the Times reported identifying 17 federal regulations with roughly 5,000 restrictions and rules relevant to apple orchards alone. The owners of the farm complained it was too much, too onerous, too big a burden, and a big reason why small businesses struggle to stay in business. But the article did spark some pushback, some of it from other farmers who say the article was a one-sided effort that missed the point, that regulations are in place to protect workers and to protect the food-consuming public. And by the way, a recent review of worker safety found that farm work is a lot more dangerous than police work and some of the most deadly in the country. So this hour, a conversation about regulations, what is and what is not appropriate. My guests in studio include Andy Fellens, who is the owner of Fellens Family Farm. That's in Phelps. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Doss.
Elizabeth Henderson is a retired farmer and writer. I've got to get used to that, but you might know her from Peacework Organic Farm and the CSA movement, CSA contracts and guidelines. She's been here many times. Great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And on the line with us is Peter Ten Eyck. He is the owner of Indian Ladder Farms, quoted in the piece. Peter, thanks for taking the time for us. How are you?
Well, thanks for your interest in anything that involves agriculture.
You got it. Peter, was for our readers who have checked the piece out, I want to get your take on it. Listeners, if you haven't seen the piece from the New York Times on farm regulations, we'll link to it in our various platforms for you so you can see it. Did you think the piece was fair, Peter?
Well, I came away very impressed with what the New York Times did in terms of, excuse me, fact-checking, and they went to other farms. They even went to farms in Oregon and in Delaware and different places. And the final thing, there was an hour and 40 minutes my daughter and I spent just on fact-checking. They want to say, I want to say this. Is this right? Or is that right? Or is the other thing right? I was very impressed. I've been a little grumpy about the New York Times in the past, but now I'm a fan of theirs.
Well, now, the assumption I would make there, Peter, is because a lot of Republicans don't like the New York Times. Your family, I don't even think the Times piece mentioned, has a lot of connections. I mean, you've had members of Congress in the family. So is this turning them around on the New York Times?
Well, it's, excuse me, I'm sorry. My daughter and son we're transitioning to another generation, and they're going to be taking over, and I'm going to be stepping in the background. So that's sort of the family right now. And they're middle of the road, Democratic point of view, and I'm a Republican. So we do have a little bit of difference there, but, you know, middle of the road, anything is good in this country.
Well, let me ask Andy Fellens, the owner of Fellens Family Farm, who is not only a farmer, but you do some teaching of other farmers about regulations, Andy?
I've been working with NOFA New York and involved in doing training on the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Okay, and what did you make of the New York Times piece? Fair?
I thought it was fair, but it had a little bit of too much of an emphasis that the regulation is bad without going more into the nuance of why some of those regulations are there in the first place.
Okay. Elizabeth Henderson, what did you make of the piece?
Well, I agree with what Andy just said. And the problem right now is that there are some regulations that are really needed that the administration is holding up. Almost the entire organic movement wants the organic livestock and poultry processing regulation to be pushed forward. It was ready. It was on the verge of being implemented, and the administration has pushed it off to benefit a few very, very large organic egg producers who like the regulations the way they are. But the organic regulations are ones that organic farmers have imposed upon ourselves. Even before the government came into it, we were following very similar regulations, and the National Organic Program implemented pretty much the same standards, but on a national scale. what was easier before was that we could constantly change and tighten and make the regulations higher and more demanding as we learned more, and that was what we wanted to do. And the organic livestock one would do that, making the regulations more humane for the treatment of poultry and other livestock. And the community of farmers and people who support the farmers are very much in favor of that. We want to have high standards. You shouldn't really need a regulation to implement the wording of the original legislation, which said that livestock should have access to the outdoors. That's pretty plain language.
But we do.
And clear.
We need that clearly in this
But
country.
We need more detail because there are people who cheat or who bend the regulation. So instead of letting the chickens go out and scratch around on the ground, the chickens can go out on this little porch where they can see the outdoors, but it doesn't allow the chicken to act like a chicken and eat worms.
All right,
so let
me just step in for 1 second, because where Elizabeth is going, there's several branches of reasons for having regulation in the first place. And one of the things that Elizabeth Henderson is talking about is humane treatment of animals. So that's one. Of course, there is worker safety. On a list of 25 most dangerous jobs in America, just reviewed last week by the website 24/7 Wall Street on new data, here are some of the numbers. Agricultural workers in this country came in 10th most dangerous job in the country. It is significantly more dangerous than even policing work. And by the way, the average annual wage for agricultural workers is only about $22,000. And number 8 on the list of most dangerous jobs in America is farmers, ranchers, and agricultural managers, 50% more dangerous than police work. So some of the regulations are in effect to protect workers. And then there are regulations in effect to protect consumers. And so this comes from Jordan Barab, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Labor at OSHA during the Obama administration. And he wrote a piece that the New York Times missed the point on regulatory fatigue. I'll read a little bit from his review, and then we'll ask our panelists to weigh in. He writes the following, quote, buried in paragraph 6 of an article on page 11 of the New York Times piece, right next to an article on new corporate loopholes provided by the Republican tax bill, are statistics noting that about 48 million Americans get sick from foodborne diseases every year, according to the FDA. And of these, 128,000 are hospitalizations, 3,000 people die. That's right, more than 8 people die from food contamination every day of the year in this country. And so Barab says, so imagine my surprise when I saw a front page article in the New York Times alleging that the scourge of small farms is not food contamination deaths or deaths in the workplace or environmental contamination, but rather government regulation that threatens the nation's small businesses that are just trying to mind their own business and make a bit of money, end quote. So my guess is everybody who's in farming agrees there are reasons for regulations, and what we're looking for is the Goldilocks zone. What's the sweet spot of enough regulation to protect consumers, workers, livestock, the animals that we work with, but what's too much? What becomes burdensome to farmers? And Peter, in the piece, it seems like you think we're way overboard with regulations. Is that fair?
Well, I'm along with Elizabeth, and I'm sorry I didn't catch the name.
That's Andy Fellens, yep.
Andy. we got to have regulations. We have tremendous, we have all my life, and I've been in this game a long time, it kind of alternates between you're going to get killed by pesticide residues or you're going to get killed by food poisoning. And in the extreme situations, there are situations like that. But how do you address them? And how do you address the issue of the big business versus the little business? And the people that make up the regulations are not the people that have to employ them. And so what we end up with is they say 5,000 rules I have to, I don't know how many there are, but there's certainly more rules than I can obey. That is for sure. We got to find a way to close the gap between the people who have to carry out the regulation and the person who puts up the rule, who usually somebody sitting in an office somewhere looking at the screen. They have an obligation to make sure they have something which is more onerous than the one not onerous, but from their point of view, safer in addressing the issues that we have in society without the worrying about implementing them. And so when I end up with a rule that says that when I pick apples, I have to put them in the bin, and I have maybe a 2 or 3 minute drive for the tractor to get into the pack house, that I have to cover each bin with a cloth to keep bird droppings off it, is probably nothing that we could all say is something that has to happen. But anyway, that's the rule, and you have to put a cloth over the. They've been sitting there for 150 days growing on the tree, but that last 2 or 3 minutes is necessary to put a wrapping on top of the bin. I think it's, and the fact that they don't interact one agency with another, I haven't any argument with the causes of why we have to have the regulations or the need to have the regulations, which we do, but we have to have regulations which are doable, which we can comply with in one way or another. And so one agency doesn't think of another agency, and so we're dealing with half the time our issue is with food service, food poisoning and this kind of stuff, that's the FDA. And then I have other issues that deal with the labor side of the things. And then I have we had a labor standards inspection this fall in the middle of harvest, where my son and daughter and I was only involved minimally, and the bookkeeper and one other person there, we invested 40 hours to meet all of the requirements of what they asked for. Complete payroll records of every employee for the previous 3 years. Home addresses of all employees with phone numbers where they can be contacted. And it went on and on and on and on. And we compiled all those papers for them because they're trying to find out if we were one of the wrongdoers. And we could have been. We could have been a really bad guy on it. But a little common sense has to come in somewhere along the line. One example that was in the article that I felt was a good example was my GAP certification plan, which we are very much committed to food safety as a number one priority for us. I mean, we grow food, and we have to grow safe food, and we can't be poisoning anybody or making them sick. Was that when the men go out to pick apples in the morning, I have to send a scout out into the orchard, and they have to survey looking for mouse and deer droppings. And if they find anything, I have to remediate. Well, what does that mean? You know, I've got 6 inches of grass in the orchard, and whether I'm going to find a mouse dropping or not, I don't know. But we went ahead, and because you're allowed to change your GAP certification program if they permit you to do it, although they have not told me that what I did was right, but I changed my own plan to say that we're going to train the guys, which we've done, don't grab the rails of the ladder. Because your boots touch the ground, and then touch the rung of the ladder, and then your hands touch the rung, and then your hands touch the apple, there could be a pathway there for contamination. Only use the rails of the ladder. Grab the sides of the rails. Do not touch the rungs. Now, I don't know whether that's going to be found to be okay or not, but it's a modification I made on my own with no venue to find out whether that's going to be acceptable to anybody. But it's those kinds of dialogues that go on. And in terms of food safety, you try to do the best you can. Our plan calls for 23. We only have one building that we pack in. It's 4,000 square feet, 100 feet on one side and 40 on another. It has 23 mouse traps, and on the wall, the bait stations, and on the wall has to be a number and then a number on the trap so you can immediately see whether there's supposed to be a trap there and it isn't, and they have to be inspected, and there's a clipboard has to show the results of those inspections.
And you're not allowed to have a dog in there to eat the mice, right?
Well, I don't know if a dog would do that or not. Probably not. But anyway, there's no sense. It sounds like I'm starting to whine. I'm not. What I'm asking for is a chance for us to visit the overall scope of different organizations. One of our biggest problems is the county health department. They come out, they have the post-season inspections, and they have the during-season inspections. I have, I think, a dozen now we're up to of water inspections that have to be made. We have to have safe water. A dozen water inspections is a lot of water inspections. Can there be another way to do this? I don't know, but when you take one agency and put it on top of another agency, and when you take it that you're not a big plant of some type that has got people who do things like that, you just got a family with 2 or 3 members in it, how can we expect to have compliance with this stuff in some kind of a way where we can actually get the job done?
So Peter, let me just ask a couple questions, and then I'll turn it over to our guests in studio as well. You told the New York Times, and you sort of hinted at it in this conversation, you said that you think that these regulations come, and I'm going to quote you in the New York Times, from people looking at a computer screen dreaming up stuff. End quote. You really believe that it's just people trying to outdo the previous regulator with something more onerous?
I really honestly believe that the people who are making up the regulation are operating under a different set of scenarios, and they don't know what the actual situation is, or you wouldn't come up with the idea of putting a cloth on top of a bin of apples to go, 400 or 500 yards into the orchard, and from the orchard to the packing house.
Okay. And so,
use words like find something and then remediate, which is simply passing the buck to somebody else without, they don't know how to remediate, so they're just simply saying you dream up something.
Okay, so too vague. I take that point there. You also said that, you told the New York Times that there's a psychological hit because they, quote, they are there to find something wrong with you and then they are going to fine you, end quote. Oddly, though, the story goes on to say that during your fall inspections, they only found a couple of little problems, and your daughter said labor investigators were professional and fair, and then they agreed to waive the fines.
Yes, they were. And since then, we have met with the food safety people who Ag and Markets carry out the food safety program now that's just being implemented from the federal government. And they're bending over backwards to work with us to give feedback to the FDA to find a kinder and gentler way that we can implement a program on the farm. There were four of them came there, and I got to say that they are really working very hard to do exactly what you'd want to do is how do you make the little guy be able to comply with the law, and they're going to use it other places too. So there are good things. Well, there, obviously, most of all these people are good people, but there are this and that and the other thing, but there's just so many of them that it's overwhelming. I mean, I'd hate to guess how many inspections I have a year.
Okay. How many workers do you have at your farm?
Well, there are really only five of us full-time employees, and then we have the thing called the fall. And then we go up and have maybe a dozen people picking apples and hauling in apples, and then our business is selling directly to the public rather than selling through the chain stores. I'm not smart enough to sell apples to Walmart. So they beat me in straight sets. So the only way I can sell my apples is directly to the public, which incidentally is another good point. And the reason I can sell directly to the public is I don't have to give them a perfect apple. I can give them apples that have marks on them where I don't have to put sprays on the orchard for cosmetic reasons. Mm-hmm. Supermarkets only take perfect apples.
Yeah, I certainly take that point. And we've heard that from farmers many times over the years, how we're almost fearful of a tiny little bruise on a piece of fruit. I take that point. One other question for Peter, and we're going to go back to our guest in studio in a moment here.
I don't want to hog all the time.
No, that's okay. See, this is instructive. We're trying to understand what life is like on farms here. And Peter, what do the workers who work in the fall for you get paid?
They get paid. The wage this year is going to be $12.83 an hour. And so that becomes my minimum wage, because anybody who does anything that they do has to be paid that same wage.
Okay.
Because they're H-2A workers, right?
Yes. Now, the federal government, now again, I don't want to be a whiner or anything, but I don't have any say about what my wage is going to be. The federal government will do a survey, and they come out with a wage, and that is the wage I have to pay. It's not one I dreamt up. It's that becomes the wage. It's just announced in regulation. That's what you're going to pay these people.
Would you like to pay less?
No. No, I want to find ways to pay people what they're worth. And they're worth more than $12.83 an hour. And the minimum wage people are worth more than, what is it, $10 and some cents mm-hmm. an hour. Well, some of them are worth that. The teenagers, it's a close call. But no, I want to pay people more money. And I think that the people who run farms ought to receive more money. The ratio between what they take out of a farm on a per-hour basis and a worker does is very narrow. But we have to find a way to have people participate in making that happen, because the farms, as people know, are not deep pockets. You don't have the ability to reach in there and just say, I'm going to pay you more money.
Sure, but Peter, you would be able to pay them more money if what?
If I was able to market my products in a way that the public who buys them through a chain store or something like that, the people, they're paying me about 30% of the price they're paying for the fruit is what I get out of the deal. and they don't change it or do anything to it. They just put it on the shelf.
But the biggest regulator, according to the New York Times piece, turns out not to be the government, but Whole Foods. And they write the following. Don't expect to find apples from Indian Ladder for sale at Whole Foods. Since 2014, Mr. Ten Eyck has jumped through all the hoops required by Whole Foods to bring his apples to market. He said, but only a small number ever made it to shelves, and he blamed Whole Foods' red tape. Mr. Ten Eyck said, we meet all of their standards and everything they want, but they can't get out of their own way. End quote.
Yeah, that turns out to be their particular. That's just a little side thing. That's the case they have. I farm with a group of growers, fruit growers, called Eco Apple, and we have a special set of standards that we hold ourselves to, that are different than the typical growers. And when Whole Foods came up with their standards for why they wanted to have best to growers. Mm-hmm. They used Eco Apple as a good input to that thing, so that I met their standards by virtue of being an Eco Apple grower. But the fact they can't get their act together again, that stays in the story. It has nothing to do with what they were trying to write the story about.
Okay.
Whole Foods was not going to pay you anymore for meeting those higher standards, were they?
No.
And isn't that part of the problem, that there are very few big commercial outlets that are buying from farmers, and they control the prices?
If you want to talk about my arguments with chain stores say we're total slaves to the consumer. The consumer wants this. I put unwaxed apples on the shelf, and then I put waxed apples next to them, and they buy all waxed apples, and they don't buy unwaxed apples. So after they tell me that, I said, well, does that mean if I installed a $75,000 apple waxing machine at the checkout counter and I said to the consumer, excuse me, ma'am, would you like me to put a foreign substance on your apples for you, that they would say yes? And the fact of the matter, they wouldn't say yes, but we still wax apples. I don't wax any apples, but I mean, that's still the way the apples show up in the stores, mostly are waxed.
Well, but here's why I'm asking these questions. I want farms to succeed in a way that is good for the farm owners, good for the workers, good for the consumers, safe for everybody. And what we're trying to figure out through this New York Times piece and through this conversation is what is impeding some farms from succeeding, at least at a higher level, from paying their workers more, from getting to market in different places, from breaking through some of these barriers. And, you know, I know, Mr. Ten Eyck, you feel like largely it's the government sort of in the way. I don't know why there isn't more ire directed at the Whole Foods of the world and trying to get a public education campaign to consumers about waxed apples versus unwaxed apples, et cetera. I mean, my guess is you feel like all of those things are appropriate. What do you think?
Well, my main thing when first of all, when the New York Times called me and they wanted to take some notes and stuff, I said, well, I'm not talking to anybody unless you come here. If you invest the time to be here on the farm and spend a day with me and find out what's going on,
sure,
then chances are you'll, and they did. They did their total due diligence. I give them credit for that. And I'll have to say also that I've heard from several regulatory type agencies who are reaching out to try and address this issue. I think we have the point that there is too much regulation. Everybody's willing to agree that the need for regulation is absolutely solid. People try to say, you don't want any regulation. That's absolutely not true. I need the help and the support of people making me do things that I might forget to do or get lazy and not do. So I need regulations, but I need regulations that make sense, that can be implemented in a way that we can have a safe food supply.
All right, so listeners, if you want to call the program with any questions or comments as we talk about regulations, if you want to learn about what life is like on the farms and maybe what could change going forward, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. The New York Times story was titled, When Picking Apples on a Farm with 5,000 Rules, Watch Out for the Ladders, and it profiled Peter Ten Eyck's farm, Indian Ladder Farms. And Peter's on the line with us. Also here is Andy Fellens, owner of Fellens Family Farm in Phelps, and Elizabeth Henderson, who is a retired farmer and writer. So after this break, we'll come back and we'll ask Andy and Elizabeth for their thoughts on what could change when it comes to regulations, whether we need more or fewer, and how we would target those and make it better for farmers, better for workers, and better for the consuming public. So that's all coming up after this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Some of the most remarkable physical feats you can imagine are going to be on screen tonight at the Little Theater. It's a documentary called The Rebound, and it's about wheelchair basketball. Wait until you see these athletes. Well, next hour, we're talking about adaptive sports, inclusion, and the real competitive drive these athletes have. We'll talk about all of that and more. It's part of our Dialogue on Disability. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andy Fellens, you've been hearing some of what Peter Ten Eyck says about what he thinks could change to make for a little bit less burdensome situation for farms so they could pay their workers more, so they could break into different markets or different places. What are your thoughts on where the regulations stand, if we need more or fewer, and how you would target those?
Evan, honestly, I think that's almost the wrong question.
Okay.
It's not necessarily more or fewer. It's really looking at what are we trying to accomplish through the regulations and how do we accomplish that? Do we look at more of an outcome-based system as opposed to a prescriptive system that has the thou shalts? When you do the prescriptive with the thou shalts, you end up with 5,000 thou shalts. If you are more focused on the outcomes, you give the farms a little bit more freedom to design a system like Peter has done with the ladder example that makes sense on the farm and delivers the same outcome as a thou shalt in terms of picking up the mousetrap.
So more flexibility and outcome-based.
Yeah, I think we really need to be looking at, we have too often where one size fits all, and what makes a lot of sense for a large farm that may have several hundred seasonal employees does not necessarily make a lot of sense for the classic, quote, small farm that might be mainly family members, same people coming back every year with just a few additional employees at peak times of the season. So I'm hoping we can move more towards scale-appropriate regulation that is focused more on the outcome as opposed to just a prescriptive approach. And I'm also very concerned about the danger of regulations being used to strangle the smaller business that, and this happens a lot with the prescriptive approach, is the compliance costs can kill the small business. You're not necessarily getting a better outcome. You're filling in a lot of forms, and those forms make a lot of sense if you have several hundred people and a large chain of command in an organization. They don't necessarily make a lot of sense if it's three people and they've all been working together for 15 or 20 years. So those are the two concerns. A third concern is just our risk tolerance. How much risk are we willing to tolerate? And this is a huge, huge thing in food safety. What's the likelihood of the event? What's the potential severity of the event? And what's the extent of the event? And here I think we're losing it on the extent of the event that a larger farm, larger operation needs to be operating under a different regulatory regime than a small farm on the risk tolerance, because the small farm, if unfortunately they have an accident, that accident might impact a few people in the community. A large farm has an accident, they're distributing through Walmart, other chain stores, their product might be in 30 states, 40 states, and affecting potentially thousands of people. There's a whole different set of regulations that make sense for that large farm that has that large distribution network versus the small farm that's just selling in the community. And I don't think we have really recognition right now of how we need to adjust our regulations to reflect that, what's the appropriate risk profile.
I saw you smiling when Peter mentioned covering apples with a cloth on a two-minute drive into the facility. Are there specific examples on your farm that you feel are good examples that common sense would say, maybe a good intention here, but this is too burdensome?
Yeah, we ran into the same covering thing. We were a GAP-certified farm several years ago, and we had to write in our food safety plan that we would cover all bins as they were coming in. But the one that really sticks in my mind is my farm's a small farm. I have maybe five employees at peak season. And we had a auditor in doing our GAPS audit, and one of her real focus points was we did not have a cleanup log in our restroom, and we did not have disposable hand towels in the cleanup restroom. So she couldn't verify that we were cleaning the restroom regularly, and she couldn't verify that people were drying their hands appropriately because she couldn't see that we were consuming a certain amount of paper towels. I can see how that makes sense if you have hundreds of employees and you have lots and lots of people. I have a tough time seeing why that's a huge audit point for a farm that has 3 or 5 people working on it.
Now, Andy, you said that, you know, there should be different standards for larger operations and smaller. Isn't that true, though? I mean, if you've got fewer than 10 employees, do OSHA rules apply?
You're responsible for compliance, but you're not responsible in OSHA for all of the reporting.
So there is some difference.
There is.
Already.
There is, but in the case of GAPS, if that's a voluntary program, and no, there wasn't the flex that you're alluding to with OSHA.
Okay. Now, Elizabeth, how do you view what could or should change when it comes to regulation currently?
Well, I think what Andy said about thinking about outcomes is really important. And if the outcome that we want is to have a dense network of family-scale farms that are paying the farmers enough to keep in business, to cover their full costs of production, and pay their workers so that the people who work on farms make not a minimum wage, but a living wage, so that people enjoy the farm work and are proud to be farm workers. That is a system of food production that is worth sustaining. Then we need to think about things in a different way. We need to make sure that, like the worker protection standards, mm-hmm. which were finally improved after 20 years but are now being postponed, will actually be implemented, because that will make the use of chemicals safer on farms. We need to go back to thinking about parity payments to farmers. Parity was a system under which farm prices actually were on a level with the other prices in the economy, so that farmers were not going out of business, as we continue to lose farms right here in this state because people aren't getting enough money to cover their costs. We need to think about having farm workers have the right to organize and stand up for themselves, which we don't have in the state or nationally. We haven't changed the National Labor Relations Act to include farm workers. But if the pricing were higher, farmers were able to pay decent wages and take the time to observe reasonable safety standards, then the whole food system would be transformed. So many of the people who are consumers really want food that's grown by farmers that they know. But local farmers are having a tremendous hard time staying in business because of the constant downward pressure on pricing as big farms get bigger and the stores get bigger.
So who do you blame for that?
Get fewer. The antitrust is not being used. I mean, that's a whole set of regulations that our government is not using.
This government gave up on using antitrust years ago.
Well, right. And that has an effect on food safety on your farm, because little farms are going to go out of business because the power in the food system is with the Costcos and the Walmarts, and it's not a dialogue where people figure out together the outcomes-based measures that Andy and Pete have been talking about so eloquently.
Okay, so there's some agreement, but some differing with Elizabeth and Andy and Peter. So, Elizabeth, what's your prescription? What's step one that should happen right now in this realm that isn't happening?
Well, I think there's a bunch of regulations that we need. The organic livestock and poultry regulations need to be pushed through. The worker protection standards need to be pursued. We need to have those banning of chlorpyrifos and the other really highly toxic materials pushed through that the government is holding up. And we all need to start thinking about how we can have a price system that really rewards farms for the work we're doing.
Peter, do you agree or disagree with what Elizabeth just called for?
Our agenda is here in 102 years that we've been in business now is in Albany County or whatever you want to use, we got to stop sliding down the slippery slope of waving money in the air and hoping somebody brings us something to eat. We have to be about the business of growing at least some of our food in the fabric of our own communities. And then that's the place that we want to be in. And we want to get out of the game of being perfect in terms of fruit and stuff like that, so that people will come to the farm and get the food off the tree, actually have a kit go out in the orchard and see where something's growing and take it home. And we have to have safe food, but when the FDA does their food sample things of thousands of samples every year, they always find the same things. Well, 1% are out of tolerance. They have too much of something, or the wrong material was used for the wrong thing. But the take-home story is about half of all those samples, with 400 and some pesticides at the minimum doses allowed, have no detectable residue of anything on them. It's not rocket science to get us up into that category. That's where I want to be. I want to have somebody be able to take an apple off the tree in the fall and take a bite out of it without being worried about whether they're going to die or not.
Okay.
And so that's the space I want to be in.
All right. And so, Peter, currently, do you look at, you know, take Elizabeth's comment about antitrust and about large farms and large operations getting the advantage and all this downward pressure on small farms. Do you agree that that's happening and that this is an antitrust failure in this country?
Well, I'm not too comfortable with the word antitrust because I don't think I understand it well enough. But I know that I'm not going to be the lowest cost producer. If the consumer feels that paying less than 10% of their disposable personal income on food is too much money, then they're going to try to look. They're not going to look to me because mine's going to be a little bit more expensive to grow. So they're going to go to a factory farm, which grows in a lower cost per unit than I can. And if they think that's still too expensive, then they're going to go and buy somewhere else in the world, and buy food at a lower price. So the marketing thing is totally driven by the consumer. And so the bottom line of my little spiel here is that it's not about sustainable agriculture. It's about people thinking about sustainable cuisine.
Okay. So, Peter, one more question for you, and then I want all of our guests to answer this. It's on this subject, because you just mentioned it comes down to the consumer. Well, Joel, one of our listeners, wants to know if we can enact laws that would help local farmers. And he says this: what role do supply chains and distribution networks play? I am thinking about the fact that New York State could provide 100% of New York City's apple needs, yet we get most of our apples from, say, Washington. He says, can we enact laws that would help local farmers in that regard? Peter?
I'd not be in favor of that.
Would not be in favor. Andy?
That's a real, real hard question to answer and address. And I'm all in favor of eliminating things that we have in our market right now that distort people's prices and externalize costs of production so that someone appears to be cheaper than someone else, but doing a thou shalt that you have to buy apples from a certain location no matter what, I can't really get behind that.
Okay. Elizabeth?
Well, I think it's possible to favor local production, and consumers do have a role here of asking for that. It reduces the amount of carbon that's wasted transporting food over long distances. But the real power is in changing the whole cheap food structure that we have in this country that favors ever bigger entities and that's pushing family-scale farms out of business.
But Elizabeth, it seems to be multi-pronged, and what Peter seems to be calling for, and I think I'm hearing Andy kind of endorse, is it has to be a kind of a cultural change, just educating consumers, whether it's waxed apples versus not, whether it's understanding supply chains, whether it's understanding, you know, where your food comes from and really actually supporting local farms versus are there legal mechanisms. And do you think it's more cultural and public education, or are there other mechanisms?
I think cultural is certainly a big part of it.
Okay.
But one of the things that the whole food movement hasn't really looked at is how the workers on farms are treated. And that's the both farmers as workers and the people who work for them. And if people understood better how badly treated farm workers are, I think they would be upset to their stomachs about it. And to change that requires legislative and regulatory changes.
All right, Andy, do you agree with that?
I do, but I want to go back to on the legal.
Yep.
I would be really in favor of legal actions that reduce the ability of some of the larger businesses to externalize their costs so that they have what appears to be a lower delivered cost to the consumer, but in reality, we're paying for it in other ways, and start to see more honest pricing, that, which is what you're getting from the smaller producer right now. The smaller producer can't take advantage of some of the larger mechanisms in our economy that allow a large corporation to lay off costs on society. And if you're buying from a small guy, you're paying the full price. If you're buying from the big guy, you're not necessarily paying the full price at the grocery store because you're paying some of it in taxes and some of it in accepting losses in other areas.
Okay. Peter, what do you think about the idea that if people understood how farm workers tend to be treated, they might be ill about it?
Well, I don't know as much about that as a lot of people do, but I do know a lot of growers. And perhaps I tend to know growers like myself or like Elizabeth is. I'm not aware of people mistreating workers in any degree. I'm sorry, but that's a small sample. In our particular case, everybody gets along together. Everybody does everything the same way. We have a farm party at the end of the season, and it's put on by our farm workers. And I end up having to buy a goat every year and a few things like that. And we all meet together. We all work under the same circumstances, and everybody comes back. Nobody doesn't come back to Indian Ladder Farms. And so I take that as and when I talk to other growers, I just don't see this story about badly treated. The one exception to that might be the year-round dairy farm, where you've got workers there who are captive and they can't go anywhere else, and they're working large hours in an isolated way where they don't have exposure to anybody else. I think that that's a sensitive area. But my people are, you know, somebody came, one of these, I call them do-gooder groups, excuse me. We're here to interview your employees without you being present. They're not even a government agency, but they somehow have this power to do that. Well, I don't have any problem. If you want to do that, that's fine. Well, where are they? Well, they're down at the Nick Arena watching a basketball game. You know, they'll be back at 10 o'clock tonight. The idea that they're isolated people, I don't have a farm worker that doesn't have a cell phone. They're aware of other opportunities, and they have the mobility to take advantage of them. And it's a different way than it used to be 20, 30 years ago.
But, Pete, you said that you're paying workers, your minimum wage is $12.83 because that's the H-2A rate.
Yes.
And while that's certainly better than the national minimum wage, which is $7.25, it's not a wage that allows people to make a decent life for themselves in this country. And you yourself are not making what you are worth for the beautiful apples that you're producing. We're all of us together facing a system that keeps the cost of food low.
Yes, that's true. And the people I'm talking about that end up with that as a wage, I'm also housing them. And I'm also paying their transportation from wherever they come from to go to the farm. And I'm also driving them to the store to buy groceries and taking them to sales and garage sales, that's where they like to go to, and stuff like that. There's a lot of other expenses, which I have down as at least another $2.50 an hour, that on top of what is that, which is in the soft cost of a support system for them.
But you said yourself, you'd pay them more if you could.
Yes, I would.
And if you were getting enough money to pay those workers $30 an hour, they wouldn't require all those services from you.
I don't even think it would take $30 an hour, Elizabeth. I mean,
well, that's what it would take, I think, to have a population of farm workers who were people who lived in the community and who enjoyed doing the work and saw it as a career path for them.
Well, I don't know any farm, small-type farms like we are, where the managers are getting $30
an hour. That's exactly right. We're not getting it, and our workers aren't getting it.
Andy, go ahead.
Well, I hear what Elizabeth and Peter are saying, and I agree with the pay, but I think we also have to recognize that a lot of farm work is seasonal, and it wouldn't matter how much Peter was paying his people. If they're just coming in for a few months, he's still going to have some needs to help them out with some services so they can get around. I don't think dollars are going to obviate the need to provide some social support for someone who's just in the area for a while to support the harvest, or just in the area to do a specific job and then move to another area where they're going to be working on different farms and different crops for another portion of the year.
Okay, Elizabeth, do you agree with that?
Well, I'd like to imagine a situation where the whole community was working together to create jobs for people year-round. There are some of the farmers in Wayne County who've been able to do that as cooperatives by pooling the resources and having a packing shed so that they can have year-round jobs for people who do some picking in the summer and processing in the winter. Well, a community could do that. They could think through what kind of work could we provide for people through the year so that it wouldn't be a matter of migrants and depending for the harvesting our crop on people from countries where people are desperate enough to come to this country to do this work.
Andy, do you think that's aspirational or do you think that's within reach?
I think for a lot of what we're talking about, you're really looking at going back to the type of agricultural economy this country used to have, where there was a lot more reliance on local and there was a lot of seasonal work, that there were canneries that operated and then there were other things that operated at other times of the year. So I think that makes sense, but I think also in that you recognize that that's not necessarily going to cover 100% of your workforce. And again, I'm really concerned about one-size-fits-all solutions, that we just say, okay, if we do X, we solve the problem completely.
Which may work for a huge industrial operation, but not for felons. A small farm, a family farm.
Correct.
Okay. So and as we get ready to wrap here, I want to ask our guests to tell you where you can either find their products or maybe how they decide to purchase the food that they buy. Because one of the things I hear in this conversation, some agreement, some disagreement among our guests about different regulations and rules. Certainly the idea that if we could pay farm workers more, we should. And we want farms to be able to do that. We want farm managers to be able to keep more. But that does require some cultural change. That requires us to ask more questions about what we're eating, where it comes from, and are we only demanding cheap? And what does that mean? Not everybody can afford the same things, I understand that, but there are costs to this for only getting cheap food. So Andy, real quick, where can people understand more about Felons Family Farm, and what would you want to leave people?
You can find us on the web at felonsfamilyfarm.com or our Facebook page, Felons Family Farm, and we're primarily a CSA farm. We offer a share of the farm, and we have 5 locations where people can pick up their shares through the season, and we're at the Brighton Farmers Market year-round, and we have a seasonal farm stand at the farm in Phelps, and we also offer You Pick Strawberries at the farm in Phelps.
And Felons is F-E-L-L-E-N-Z. Peter Ten Eyck, go ahead, sir.
Well, we're IndianLadderFarms.com, and we're a fixture here in Albany County, and unfortunately, I get grumpy about keeping big refrigerated spaces running 365 days of the year. So right now we're not selling apples during the winter. So we're not in business at retail right now.
Gotcha. Elizabeth Henderson, you're retired now, but why don't you tell us this? Where are you buying your food from these days?
Well, I'm a member of the Peacework CSA core group.
Yep.
And we do our distribution at the Abundance Co-op, and that's where I buy most of my food. And people can join the Peacework CSA, which will be getting its shares this next season from Mud Creek Farm by going to mudcreek.com.
What's for dinner tonight?
Well, I'm having a corn chowder that I made from corn that I froze last season with onions and peppers that I saved. So I live like a farmer and a homesteader. I put up a lot of food during the warm season and eat it during the winter.
Thank you for coming in, as always, Elizabeth. I appreciate that. And that's another good inspiration for us. We can learn more. We can do more. We can support local. Elizabeth Henderson, Andy Fellens from Fellens Family Farm. As always, thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And Peter Tenike, I really appreciate you joining us via phone. Thanks for taking the time for us this hour.
Great. Good show.
And Peter Tenike is the owner of Indian Ladder Farm. So a lot of different perspective there, but a lot of agreement, though, on the importance of education and where your food comes from. And the question of who are you supporting with the purchasing choices you're making. More connections coming up.